I'll be in touch. I look forward to it. Gurney replaced the handset, aware he'd let pass an opportunity to tell Klein he'd decided not to get involved. He'd hardly begun to rationalize his foot dragging when he remembered the possible vehicle by the barn. He headed out through the French doors and down into the pasture. When he reached the far side of the Forsythia, he had two surprises. The first was the car. It was a sleek Audi A7, a rarity in an area where luxury vehicle usually meant a crew cab pickup with big tires. The second was that there was no one in it. He looked around. He saw no one. "Hello?" he called out. There was no response. He walked around the barn. The lush spring grass was moist with dew where the old apple trees shaded it, but there were no footprints. Back by the car, he scanned the surrounding area, the pastures, the pond, the cleared swath along the edge of the woods. No sign of anyone. As he was deciding what to do next, he heard a faint scraping sound. He heard it again, sharper this time, and coming, it seemed, from the thicket above the pond. The only thing he could see up there that wasn't part of the natural flora was the tractor he'd been using to clear his little archaeology site. Curious, he headed up the trail that led to the excavation. The scraping became more distinct. He came around a bend in the trail, and the broad rectangular hole came into view. But it wasn't until he reached the excavation's edge that he discovered the source of the sound. A man, intent on his work, was using a hand trowel to probe a crevice between two foundation stones. He was wearing beige slacks, expensive-looking brown loafers, and a tropical sports shirt, garishly printed with palm fronds and toucans. The man spoke without turning away from the ground. 1700, I'd say. Give or take 20 years or so. Could be as early as 1680. Interesting rust deposits along here. He tapped the area in front of him with the point of the trowel, which Gurney recognized as the one he kept at the site. 4 separate deposits at 3-foot intervals. He straightened up now, a lanky, stork-like man with thinning hair the color of his beige slacks. As he gazed at Gurney, the lenses of his horn-rimmed glasses magnified his eyes. Those remnants of chain links you mentioned in your message, they were distributed along the base of this wall, am I right? Some people were put off by Dr. Walter Thrasher's mildly autistic avoidance of the social graces, but Gurney, for whom getting to the point was a virtue, was quite comfortable with the man's approach. Right, directly below the rust spots, Gurney replied with a puzzled frown. I thought you said you were coming here tomorrow. Did I lose a day somewhere? No days lost, just happened to be passing, coming from White River, going to Albany, took a chance you might be home. Drove up to your barn, caught sight of your tractor, figured that'd be the site. Interesting, very interesting. As he was speaking, he put down the trowel and scrambled with surprising agility up the short ladder out of the excavation. Interesting in what way? Wouldn't want to answer that prematurely. Depends on the nature of the artifacts. You mentioned baby teeth and a knife? As well as some glass, bits of rusted metal, hooks for stretching animal hides. There was a peculiar intensity in Thrasher's magnified gaze. No time to examine it all right now. Maybe just the knife and the teeth? A quick look? Gurney shrugged. No problem. He thought of asking Thrasher for a ride up to the house, but the chance of the low-slung A7 bottoming out in the pasture ruts was too great. Wait here, I'll be back. Thrasher was standing by his car when Gurney returned with the knife and the tinted glass jar containing the teeth. Thrasher gave the knife, especially what appeared to be the fingernail-sized crescent moon carved in the black handle, a close but rapid inspection. Ending with a nod and a grunt of satisfaction, he handed it back to Gurney. He took the tinted jar with greater care, almost a kind of trepidation, at first holding it up to examine the contents through the glass, then removing the top and peering in at the tiny teeth. He slowly tipped the jar, carefully letting just one tooth slide out onto his palm. He tilted his hand this way and that to view it from different angles. Then he tipped it back into the jar and replaced the lid. Would it be all right if I borrowed this for a day or two? Need my microscope to verify what we've got here? He You're not sure they're baby teeth? Oh, they're definitely baby teeth, no doubt about that. Well then, Thrasher hesitated, looked momentarily troubled. There could be more than one way they ended up in this jar. Until I take a closer look, let's leave it at that. 11. There were two paths from the barn up to the house. The more direct one that they used as a driveway went up through the pasture. The roundabout one meandered through the woods below the pasture, then curved up around it to the far side of the henhouse and the bluestone patio. Gurney chose the second route. He paid attention to the forest sights, sounds, scents, the rustlings and chirpings, the sweetness in the air, the tiny blue flowers among the lush ferns, trying to dispel a vague sense of uneasiness created by Thrasher's parting comment. As he was heading for the house by this alternate route, he heard a vehicle approaching on the town road. Soon he saw a small white car coming around the barn. It slowed and began to make its way haltingly up through the pasture. It came to a stop 40 or 50 feet shy of the side door where Gurney's Outback was parked. A woman emerged from the car and stood for a moment by its open door. Assuming it must be Kim Steele, Gurney started across the pasture toward her. He was about to call out when she got back in the car and tried to turn it around, an attempt that ended when a rear wheel sank into one of the pasture's groundhog burrows. He found her sobbing, hands gripping the steering wheel. Her dark curly hair was disarranged. Her face was drawn. Gurney blinked, confused for a second or two by the fact that the woman in the car was part African-American, which didn't jibe with the mental image he'd constructed from the fact of her being married to an upstate white cop. Feeling some chagrin at the narrowness of his expectation and the not-so-subtle prejudice lurking under it, he cleared his throat. "And Mrs. Steele?" Her eyes had the exhausted red puffiness that comes from hours of crying. "Mrs. Steele?" She sniffled, her gaze fastened on the steering wheel. "Damn stupid car." "I can pull your car out of that hole with my tractor. Come up to the house, I'll take care of your car for you, okay?" He was about to repeat his suggestion when she suddenly opened the door and stepped out. He noticed that her shirt was unevenly buttoned. She pulled a loose khaki jacket tightly around her despite the warmth of the day. He led the way to the patio and gestured toward one of the chairs at a small metal cafe table. "Would you like something to drink? Water or coffee?" She sat at the table and shook her head. He sat in the chair opposite her. He saw grief, exhaustion, indecision, anxiety. He spoke softly. "It's hard to know who to trust, isn't it?" She blinked, looking at him now in a more focused way. "You're a retired police officer?" "I was a homicide detective with the NYPD. I took my pension after 25 years. My wife and I have been up here in Walnut Crossing for 3 years now." He paused. "Do you want to tell me why you wanted to see me?"
"I'm not sure. I'm not sure of anything."
He smiled. "That may be a good thing."
"Why?"
"I think doubt is a realistic approach to situations where there's a lot at stake." He was thinking of the times he had felt baffled and how only by talking something out with Madeline had he been able to decide what to do. He wondered if that was the kind of relationship Kim Steele had enjoyed with her husband. Maybe she'd always relied on their conversations to help resolve her doubts. Tears began to make their way down her cheeks.
"I'm sorry," she said, shaking her head. "I shouldn't be wasting your time."
"You're not wasting my time." She stared at him. He could see in her eyes the battle in her mind and its sudden resolution. She reached into the pocket of her big khaki jacket, which he realized was probably her husband's, adding a poignant note to the way she wrapped herself in it. She pulled out a smartphone. After tapping a few icons, she extended it across the table so he could see the screen. When he reached for it, she pulled back.
"I'll hold it," she said. "Just read what it says."
It was a text message. "Watch your back. Easy night for MFS to ice your ass and blame the BDA.
Gurney read it 3 times. He noted the date and time, the evening John Steele was killed about an hour prior to the shooting.
What is this?
John's phone? I found that message on it.
How come you still have it? Didn't the crime scene team want it?
It wasn't at the crime scene. On duty, they use BlackBerries. This is John's personal phone. It was at home.
When did you find the message?
Yesterday morning.
Have you shown it to the police? She shook her head. Because?
The message, what it says.
What does it mean to you?
Although she was sitting in the direct sunlight, she wrapped herself more tightly in the jacket. He was being warned to watch his back. Doesn't that suggest someone who was supposed to be on his side really wasn't?
You're thinking someone in the department.
I don't know what I'm thinking.
Your husband wouldn't be the first cop to have enemies. Sometimes the best cops have the worst enemies.
She met his gaze, nodding with conviction. That's who John was. The best person on earth. Totally honest.
Do you know if he was doing anything that less honest people in the department might have found threatening? She took a deep breath.
John didn't like to talk about work at home. Once in a while, I'd overhear something when he was on the phone. Comments about past cases with questionable evidence. Deaths in custody. Throwdowns. You know what they are, right?
He nodded. Some cops wouldn't go anywhere without one. An easily concealed, unregistered, untraceable pistol that could be dropped next to the body of someone the cop had shot as evidence that the victim had been armed. How did he know which cases to look into? She hesitated, appeared uncomfortable.
Maybe he had some contacts?
People who pointed him in the direction of specific cases?
Maybe.
People in the Black Defense Alliance?
I don't really know.
She was a lousy liar. That was okay. It was the good liars he worried about. Did he ever tell you how high up in the department the problems might go? She said nothing. Her deer-in-the-headlights expression was answer enough. What made you come to me?
I read about that Peter Pan murder case you solved last year, how you exposed the police corruption behind it.
The explanation sounded real as far as it went. How did you know where to find me? The deer-in-the-headlights look was back. It told him that she couldn't tell the truth, but wouldn't tell a lie. It was, he thought, the reaction of an honest person in a difficult spot. Okay, he said. We'll let that go for now. What would you like me to do for you?
She answered without hesitation. I want you to find out who killed my husband. 12. While Kim Steele waited on the patio, Gurney got his tractor from the excavation site, pulled her car from the collapsed groundhog burrow, and got it oriented in the right direction. He promised to look into the White River situation. As she was leaving, she shook hands with him, and for a couple of seconds a smile relieved the desolation in her eyes. Once she was safely on the town road, he went into the house, opened a new document on his computer, and, from memory, typed in the text from her husband's phone. Then he called Jack Hardwick and left on his voicemail a summary of what Kim had told him and a request that he use his contacts to dig a little deeper into the backgrounds of Del Beckert and his number 2, Judd Turlock. Then, for good measure, he emailed Hardwick a copy of the text message. Next, he took his cell phone out to the patio where the signal was strongest, activated its record function, and called Sheridan Klein's private number. The man picked up on the second ring, oozing a warmth that didn't quite conceal an edge of anxiety. Dave, great to hear from you. So, tell me, where do we stand?
Well, that depends on how accurately I understood your invitation. Let me spell out what I'm agreeing to. Full LEO authority, credentials, and protections as a member of your investigation staff, investigatorial autonomy with a sole reporting line to you personally, and compensation at the standard hourly rate for senior contract investigators. Contract is to be open-ended, cancelable by either party at any time. Have I got it right?
You recording this?
You have a problem with that?
No problem at all. I'll have the contract prepared. There's a CSMT meeting this afternoon at White River Police Headquarters, Critical Situation Management Team, 3:30.
Meet me in the parking lot at 3:15. You can sign the contract, attend the meeting, get off to a running start. See you there.
As Gurney entered the call, a chicken in the pen by the asparagus patch let out a startling squawk. It was a sound that still struck him with the visceral impact of an alarm, even though he'd learned during his year of chicken tending that the sounds they made rarely had any decipherable purpose. Utterances that resembled cries of distress never seemed to coincide with the presence of threats of any kind. Still, he ambled over to the pen to assure himself that all was well. The big Rhode Island Red was standing in that perfect chicken pose, presenting the classic profile featured in country craft art. It reminded him that he needed to sweep out the coop, change the water, and refill the feeder. While Madeline always seemed pleased by the variety of her roles in life, Gurney's reaction to his diverse responsibilities was less positive. A therapist had long ago advised him to actively be everything he was, a husband to his wife, a father to his son, a son to his parents, a fellow worker to his workmates, a friend to his friends. He insisted that balance and peace in one's life depended on participating in each part of that life. Gurney had no argument with the logic of this. As a guiding principle, it felt true and right. But he recoiled from the practice of it. For all its horrors and perils, his detective work was the only part of his life that came naturally to him. Being a husband, a father, a son, a friend, all of these required a special effort, perhaps even a special kind of courage that tracking down murderers did not. Of course, he knew in his heart that being a man meant more than being a cop, and leading a good life often meant swimming against the current of one's inclinations. He also felt the nudging of an axiom his therapist was fond of repeating. The only time a man can do the right thing is right now. So, embracing a sense of duty and purpose, he got the utility broom from the mudroom and headed for the chicken coop. With an energizing sense of accomplishment from having dealt with the dirt, the water, and the feed, he decided to go on to another maintenance task that needed doing, the mowing of the broad path that encircled the high pasture. That activity did promise certain distinct pleasures, the bursts of fragrance rising from the patches of wild mint, the view from the top of the pasture out over the unspoiled green hills, the sweet air, the cerulean sky. At the end of the pasture path, he came to the trail above the pond that led to his excavation. Although the shaded grass there was slower growing, he decided to mow it as well, proceeding under the canopy of cherry trees until he arrived at the excavation itself. He stopped there, picturing the artifacts he'd uncovered and pondering Thrasher's strange comment on the teeth. Something told him it would be best to put it out of his mind and finish the mowing job. But that idea was replaced by another, to spend a few minutes digging down a few additional inches along the foundation, just to see if anything of interest might turn up. His tractor, with the mini backhoe attachment, was still up by the house, but there was a spade by the excavation. He went down the little ladder and began prying shovelfuls of soil away from the base of the stone wall that Thrasher had been probing. Working his way along it, finding nothing but more soil, and suspecting that he was becoming a trifle obsessive, he decided to return to his mowing. Then, as he turned over a final shovelful, he noted something solid. He took it at first to be just a hardened lump of reddish-brown clay. But when he picked it up and worked it in his hands, he discovered, embedded in the clay, a rusted piece of iron, thick and curved. As he dislodged more of the caked soil, he saw that it was a circle of iron, perhaps 3 inches in diameter, with a thick chain link attached to the side of it. While he realized that it could have a variety of uses, one in particular was obvious. It looked very much like some form of shackle, like half of a primitive set of handcuffs. 13. The westbound drive to White River consisted of a gradual descent from modest mountains and sloping meadows through rolling hills and broad valleys into a region of shabby strip malls. The final symbol of the area's economic depression was the abandoned White River Stone Quarry, made famous by the sensational news coverage of an explosion that killed 6 passing motorists
bankrupted the company and led to the unnerving discovery that someone had made off with more than 100 sticks of dynamite. Gurney's GPS led him into the center of the cheerless city on an avenue that bordered the partly burned and looted Grinton section. At the end of the avenue stood White River's police headquarters. A world apart from the picturesquely dilapidated barns and tilting silos of Walnut Crossing, the building was constructed of gray-beige brick in the boxy style of the 1960s. Its treeless, grassless setting was as sterile as its aluminum-framed windows and concrete parking lot, both the color of dust. As he reached the entrance to the lot, a man sitting on what appeared to be a small furniture dolly rolled by, propelling himself along the sidewalk with his gloved hands. He was wearing a grimy army surplus jacket and a baseball hat. Looking closer, Gurney could see that the man was legless below the knees, and the gloves were actually oven mitts. An American flag hung limply from the top of an old broomstick that was affixed to the back of the dolly. With each thrust of his hands, the man cried out repetitively in a voice as abrasive as a rusty hinge, "Sunshine! Sunshine! Sunshine!" When Gurney drove into the lot, the first vehicle to catch his eye was Klein's gleaming black Navigator. In a row marked reserved, it occupied the space nearest the building's front door. He parked next to it, got out of his car, and was struck immediately by the odor of smoke, burned plastic, wet ashes. The Navigator's tinted rear window descended and Klein peered out at him, at first with a look of satisfaction, then concern. "Everything all right?" "Bad smell." "Arson. Pointless stupidity. Get in, I have your contract." Gurney slid into the back seat across from Klein, a luxuriously isolated environment of plush leather and soft lighting. "High-class vehicle," said Gurney. "No cost to the taxpayer." "Confiscation?" "Forfeiture of property employed in the facilitation of drug trafficking." Perhaps interpreting Gurney's silence as a criticism of the controversial practice of seizing an accused individual's assets prior to trial, Klein added, "The bleeding hearts like to whine about the tiny number of cases where there's some inconvenience to a guy who ends up beating the rap. But 99 times out of 100 we're just transferring ill-gotten goods from scumbags to law enforcement. Perfectly legal and personally satisfying." He clicked open an attaché case on the seat between them, pulled out 2 copies of the contract, and handed them to Gurney with a pen. "I've signed these. You sign both. Give me one and keep one for yourself." Reading through the contract, he was surprised to find no surprises, no subtle changes from the provisions he'd demanded on the phone. Oddly, this straightforwardness aroused his suspicion. He was sure everything Klein did was some sort of stratagem. Honesty would always be a route to something more important, but he could hardly object to the contract on that basis. "So, about this meeting, is there an agenda?" "Just to share the known facts, establish priorities, application of resources, media guidelines, get everyone in sync." "Everyone being who?" "Adele Beckert, Beckert's right hand, Judd Turlock, Chief Investigating Officer Mark Torres, Mayor Dwayne Shucker, Sheriff Goodson Klautz." He paused. "A word of warning on Klautz, so you're not taken by surprise. He's blind."
"Blind?
As a bat, supposedly. Wily country boy who talks like a hillbilly. Runs the county jail. Always gets re-elected, unopposed, the last 3 times. "Any particular reason he's part of this so-called team?"
"No idea."
"They all expecting me?"
"I gave Beckert a heads up, left it up to him to fill in the others."
"Any liaisons to outside agencies? FBI, State Police, AG's office?"
"We're keeping the FBI out unless we're forced to let them in.
Beckert has his own back channels to the State Police, to be used at his discretion. As for the AG's office, they have more than they can handle with the new issues around the AG's death."
"What new issues?"
"Some embarrassing questions. The fact that he died in a Vegas hotel room creates speculation. Prurient suggestions." He grimaced, glanced at his Rolex, then at the contract in Gurney's lap. "It's meeting time. You want to sign that so we can go in?"
"One more question."
"What?"
"As I'm sure you know, I met with Kim Steele this morning.
She gave me her perspective on her husband's death along with the evidence she found on his phone. He paused, watching Klein's face. I wondered who sent her to me, then I realized it had to be you. Klein's eyes narrowed. Why me? Because what she told me was a direct answer to the question I'd raised with you about what you were leaving out of your description of the situation, the text message on Steele's phone and its possible implications. Kim was afraid to take it to the local police, who she didn't trust, so she took it to you. But it was too touchy a matter for you to share with me, as long as I was outside the tent. But if the victim's wife told me about it on her own, you'd be clear of any blowback. Plus, a visit from a grieving widow would put pressure on me to accept your offer. Klein stared straight ahead, said nothing. Gurney signed both copies of the contract, handed one to Klein, and slipped the other into his jacket pocket. The inside of the White River Police Headquarters was a predictably drab reflection of the outside. With buzzing fluorescent lights, stained acoustic ceiling tiles, and the smell of a disinfectant whose ersatz pine aroma was mixing with the sourness of whatever was being disinfected. Klein ushered him quickly through a security checkpoint and led him down a long corridor with colorless cinder block walls. At the end of the corridor, they passed through an open door into an unlit conference room. Klein felt for a light switch and pressed it. Fluorescent tubes flickered on. The wall opposite the door was devoted mainly to a wide window over which blinds had been lowered. A long conference table stood in the center of the room. On the wall to the left was a whiteboard on which CSMT 330 had been printed with a black marker. According to a circular clock above the board, it was now 3:27. Looking to his right, Gurney was surprised to see the chair at the end of the table was occupied by a thin man with dark glasses. A white cane lay on the table in front of him. Klein turned with a start. Goodson, I didn't see you sitting there.
But now you do, Sheridan. Of course I can't see you. Being kept in the dark's my natural state. It's the cross I bear, to be forever at the mercy of my sighted companions.
Nobody in this part of the world is less in the dark than you, Goodson. The thin man cackled. The exchange had the tone of a jokey ritual that had long since lost what humor it may once have contained. Footsteps approached in the corridor, accompanied by the sound of someone blowing his nose. A short, fat man stepped into the room, recognizable to Gurney from the press conference as Mayor Duane Shucker, holding a handkerchief to his face.
"God damn it, Shucks," said the blind man. "Sounds like you got yourself pollinated."
The mayor stuffed his handkerchief in the pocket of his too small sport jacket, took a seat at the opposite end of the table, and yawned.
"Nice to see you, Sheriff."
He yawned again, looked at Klein.
"Hey there, Sheridan. Leaner and meaner than ever. Meant to ask you at that press affair, you still running the marathons?"
"I never did, Duane, just the occasional 5K.
5Ks, 50Ks, all the same to me."
Sniffling again, he gave Gurney a once-over.
"You're our DA's new investigator?"
"Right." The thin man at the other end of the table raised his blind man's cane in a kind of salute.
"I knew there was another party in the room, just wondered when you'd make yourself known. Gurney, is it?"
"Right."
"Man of action. I've heard about your exploits. I hope our modest level of mayhem up here in the backwoods don't bore you."
Gurney said nothing. Klein looked uncomfortable. The man replaced his cane carefully on the table and produced a lizardy smile.
"Seriously, Mr. Gurney, tell me, what's your big city impression of our little problem here?"
Gurney shrugged. "My impression is that little might be the wrong word."
"Tell me what word would you..."
He was interrupted by the energetic entry into the room of two men. Gurney recognized the tall one in a crisply tailored dark suit as Del Beckert. He was carrying a slim briefcase. The other man, presumably Judd Turlock, in a nondescript sport jacket and slacks, combined the body of a defensive lineman with the impassive face of a mobster in a mugshot. Beckert nodded to Klein, then turned to Gurney.
"I'm Del Beckert. Welcome. You've met everyone?"
Without waiting for an answer, he continued.
We're missing Mark Torres, CIO on the homicide. He's been delayed a few minutes, but let's get started. He strode around to the other side of the table, chose the center chair, placed his briefcase squarely in front of it, and sat down. Can we get some more light in here? Judd Turlock stepped behind Beckert's chair and raised the blinds carefully and evenly. Gurney, in the seat across from Beckert, was struck by the stark composition of the view framed by the picture window. A black macadam road, bordered by chain-link fences topped with razor wire, extended out from the police headquarters to another colorless brick building, several times larger but with narrower windows. A black-and-white sign identified it as the Halden C. Eppert Detention Center, official name of the county lockup. Looming on a rise a few hundred yards beyond it, with a massive concrete wall and guard towers of what Gurney recognized as the White River Correctional Facility, the state prison named after its city host. With this bleak tableau serving as a backdrop for the man at the center of the table, it occurred to Gurney that if someone in a fanciful moment should consider those incarceration facilities as a kind of hell, then Beckert had positioned himself as hell's gatekeeper. To keep us on track, we have an agenda. Beckert reached into his briefcase and pulled out some papers. Turlock passed one to each man at the table. Beckert added, "Orderly process is important, especially when we're confronting an insane level of disorder." Gurney scanned the terse list of topics. It was orderly, but revealed little. "We'll start with the RAM cam videos from the Willard Park homicide site," said Beckert. "The digital files are being..." He stopped at the sound of hurried footsteps in the corridor. A moment later, a slim, young Hispanic man entered the room, nodded apologetically all around, and took a seat at the table between Gurney and the sheriff. Turlock slid a copy of the agenda across the table, which the young man examined with a thoughtful frown. Gurney extended his hand to him. "I'm Dave Gurney with the DA's office." "I know." He smiled, looking more like an earnest college kid than the chief investigating officer on a major homicide. "I'm Mark Torres, White River PD." With a flicker of irritation, Beckert continued, "The original digital files are being enhanced at the forensic computer lab. These will serve our purposes for now." He nodded at Turlock, who tapped a few icons on a small tablet computer. A large video monitor high on the wall behind the sheriff came to life. The first segment of the video was a longer version of the clip Gurney had seen at Marv and Trish Gelter's house. The extra length consisted of several minutes of additional footage prior to the actual shooting, the period during which Officer Steele was walking back and forth on the sidewalk at the edge of the park, his attention on the crowd. At the side of the crowd, as if preparing to charge into it on his great stone horse, was the larger-than-life statue of Colonel Ezra Willard. Perhaps because there was less distraction here than at the Gelters, or because this portion of the video was longer, Gurney noticed something he'd originally missed, a tiny red dot moving on the back of Steele's head. The dot followed Steele for at least 2 minutes prior to the fatal shot, stopping when he stopped, moving with him when he moved, centering itself on the base of his skull just below the edge of his protective helmet. The fact that it was obviously the projected dot of a rifle's laser sight gave Gurney a sick feeling. Then the bullet struck, knocking Steele face down onto the sidewalk. Even though Gurney knew it was coming, he flinched. The reassuring words of a wise man he'd once known came back to him. "Flinching at another's injury is the essence of empathy, and empathy is the essence of humanity." At a gesture from Beckert, Turlock stopped the video and switched off the monitor. The silence in the room was broken by Mayor Shucker.
"The damage being done to the business people of this city by that damn RAMCAM video is just awful. They run the damn thing over and over, makes our little city look like a war zone, a place to avoid. We have restaurants, B&Bs, the museum, kayak rentals, the tourist season about to start, not a damn customer in sight. This media thing is killing us."
Beckert showed no reaction. He looked toward the opposite end of the table.
"Goodson, I know the video's already been described to you in detail. Comments?"
Clouds fingered his white cane with an unpleasant smile.
"I do appreciate Shucks's business concerns. Natural for a man invested in the economy of the city to feel that way. On the other hand, I do see some value in giving folks around the state a glimpse of the barbarian shit we're facing here. Folks need to see it to appreciate the steps we need to take.
Gurney thought he detected a nod of agreement from Beckert.
Other comments?
Klein shook his head.
Not at the moment.
How about our new investigator?
Gurney shrugged, his voice casual.
Why do you think it took the shooter so long?
Beckert frowned.
Long?
The dot from the laser sight was on Steele's head for quite a while.
Beckert shrugged.
I doubt that it matters. Let's move on to the next agenda item, the ME's report. Copies of the full report will be available shortly, but Dr. Thrasher has provided me with the salient points.
He removed a sheet of paper from his briefcase and read aloud.
Henry John Steele, DOA, Mercy Hospital, cause of death, catastrophic damage to medulla oblongata, cerebellum, and posterior cerebral artery, leading to immediate failure of heart and respiratory functions, damage initiated by the passage of a bullet through the occipital bone at the base of the skull, through critical brain and brainstem regions emerging through the lacrimal bone structure.
He replaced the paper in his briefcase.
Dr. Thrasher further estimated, informally, that the bullet was probably a 30-caliber high-energy FMJ. That estimate has now been confirmed by preliminary ballistic analysis of the bullet recovered at the Willard Park site. Any questions?
Shucker sniffled.
What the hell's an FMJ?
Full metal jacket. Keeps the bullet from expanding or fragmenting so it passes through the target intact. Plus side is that it preserves the rifling marks for ballistics so we can match the bullet to the weapon that fired it.
Assuming you recover the weapon?
Assuming we recover it. Any other questions?
Klein steepled his fingers.
Any progress finding the shooter's site?
Beckert looked at Torres.
Ball's in your court, Mark.
The young CIO looked pleased at the handoff.
We're narrowing the possibilities, sir. Aligning the position of the victim's head in the video frame that captured the impact with the position of the recovered bullet gave us a general vector for the bullet's path. We've laid that vector out on a map of the area to identify possible sites. A priority goes to those farthest from the victim since the shot wasn't heard at the site and no audible traces were picked up by the ram cams. We have patrol officers out now doing door-to-doors.
Klautz was idly stroking his cane.
And you ain't getting diddly shit cooperation from our minority citizens, am I right?
Gurney noted that the sheriff's fingernails were nicely manicured. Torres frowned, his jaw muscles tightening.
The level of cooperation has so far been uneven.
Klein continued.
Apart from the door-to-doors, Mark, what else is underway?
Torres leaned forward.
We're collecting and reviewing video data from the security, traffic, and media cameras in the area. A careful examination of that data is likely to...
Mayor Shucker broke in.
What I want to know is, do we have any real leads on them sons of bitches on the run? That's gotta have priority. Catch them, incarcerate them, and put this goddamn nightmare to rest.
There was a hard edge to Beckert's voice.
Jordan and Tooker are at the top of our list. We're going to get them. That's a personal guarantee.
Shucker seemed mollified. Klein steepled his fingers again.
Can we tie them directly to the shooting?
We know from reliable informers that they were involved, and we just heard from a credible source that a third person may have been involved along with them, possibly a white male.
Klein appeared startled.
I didn't think the BDA had white members.
They don't, not technically, but they do have some white enablers, even financial supporters.
Lefty loonies need to have their goddamn heads examined, interjected the sheriff.
Klein looked pained. Beckert exhibited no reaction at all.
We hope to identify that third person and have Jordan and Tooker in custody within the next 48 hours. And we expect that Mark and his people will have conclusive physical evidence very soon from the shooter site, from BDA material seized in the raid, and from cooperating BDA members.
Speaking of which, said the sheriff, I would hope that Sheridan here will be asking the judge to set bail high enough on our BDA detainees so they don't go flying out free as fucking birds. More time we have them in custody, better our chances of getting what we need.
Gurney knew what the sheriff was talking about. He'd no doubt already separated the detainees from each other and put them in cells with jailhouse snitches who might be eager to trade incriminating information for sentence reductions. It was one of the rottenest parts of a rotten system. Beckert glanced at his watch. Any further questions?
Gurney spoke with bland curiosity.
Do you think there's any chance your hypothesis might not be correct?
What hypothesis?
That the Black Defense Alliance is responsible for the shooting.
Beckert stared at him.
What makes you ask that?
I've made some mistakes myself by getting too sure too soon. I stopped asking questions because I thought I had all the answers.
Is this a general concern, or do you have a specific pebble in your shoe?
I had a visit this morning from Kim Steele, John Steele's widow.
And?
She showed me an odd text that was sent to her husband's personal phone the night he was shot. I made a note of it.
Gurney brought it up on his phone and slid it across the table.
Beckert read through the text, frowning.
You've seen this, Sheridan?
Dave discussed it with me before we came in.
It struck Gurney that wielding the truth deceptively was one of Klein's talents.
Beckert passed the phone on to Turlock, who gazed expressionlessly at the message and then passed it back. The sheriff spoke up in an oily voice.
Could someone kindly enlighten me?
Beckert read aloud from the screen with obvious contempt for the street slanginess of the text.
Watch your back. Easy night for MFS to ice your ass and blame the BDA. How's that all about?
Ignoring the question, Beckert gave Gurney a long look.
Did you take possession of Steele's phone?
Nope.
Why not?
Mrs. Steele wasn't ready to hand it over, and I had no standing to demand it.
Beckert tilted his head speculatively.
Why would she bring this matter to you?
She referred to some work I'd done on another case.
What work?
I helped exonerate a woman who'd been framed for murder by a corrupt cop.
What relevance does that have here?
I have no idea.
Really?
None at all.
I'm determined to keep an open mind. Beckert held Gurney's gaze for a long moment.
We need that phone.
I know.
Will she surrender it willingly, or do we have to hit her with a warrant?
I'll talk to her. If I can persuade her, that would be a better route.
You do that. In the meantime, Judd will get a warrant in case we need it.
Turlock, who had been flexing his fingers and examining his knuckles, nodded.
Okay, said Beckert. That wraps it up for now. Just a final word. Procedure is key. Lack of orderly procedure produces chaos. Chaos produces failure, and failure is not an option. All communications will be routed through Judd here. He'll be the hub of the wheel. Everything flows into him, and everything flows out from him. Any questions?
There were none.
It struck Gurney as a strange arrangement, since that central role normally would be filled by the CIO, in this case Mark Torres. And the tone of bureaucratic rigidity seemed like anything but a plus. But this need for control was obviously coming from a central point in Beckert's personality, and Gurney didn't want to strain his relationship with the man any further by probing the matter. At least not for the moment. 14. Klein and Gurney left the building together, saying nothing until they reached their cars. Klein glanced around like a man wary of being overheard.
I want to clarify something, David. I don't want you thinking I'm being less than totally honest with you. In the meeting, you explained that you couldn't ask Kim Steele for the phone because at that point you had no official standing in the case. Well, that's exactly why I couldn't tell you she'd come to me. You can understand the sensitivity of the thing.
The same sensitivity that kept you from telling Beckert about it?
I was delaying slightly on that, mainly out of respect for Kim's concerns. But one thing leads to another. The best of intentions could create problems.
What problems?
Well, the simple fact of any delay at all.
If that came to light, it could create the impression that I shared Kim's mistrust of the department. That's why I chose to handle it the way I did. Not out of any desire to mislead you. By the way,
how you handled the phone business in the meeting. That was ideal. It was the truth.
Of course, and the truth can be very useful. The more truth within reason, the better.
There were beads of sweat on Klein's forehead.
From their first meeting back at the start of the Mellory case, Gurney was aware that there were two distinct layers in Klein's construction. The veneer of a confident politician with his eye on the gold ring, and beneath it, a frightened little man. What struck Gurney now was the increasing visibility of the fear. Klein looked around the lot again and checked his watch.
You see or hear anything in that meeting that surprised you?
The possible involvement of a third person was interesting.
What do you make of it?
Too soon to say.
And what's your next step?
I'd like more information.
Like what?
You want me to email you a list?
Easier this way.
He took out his phone and tapped a couple of icons.
It's recording.
I'd like to see the incident report, crime scene photos, copies of the video we just saw, ballistics report, victim bio, Jordan's and Tooker's criminal records, anything you can pry out of Beckett regarding his informants, and I'd like to know what's behind his obvious hatred for Jordan and Tooker.
Klein shut off the record function of his phone.
That last one I can answer right now. Beckert's strengths as a law enforcer come with a passion for maintaining order. He sees Jordan, Tooker, the whole BDA organization as agents of anarchy. Del Beckert and the BDA are like matter and antimatter, a huge explosion waiting to happen.
As he began his drive home, Gurney had two things on his mind. The first was Klein's obvious anxiety. It suggested that he mistrusted the handling of the case by the department or by Beckert himself. He wondered if the source of that mistrust ran deeper than the phone text. The second was the motorcycle that had been maintaining a consistent position about 100 yards behind the Outback since he'd left White River. He slowed from 70 to 60 and noted that the motorcycle did the same. He increased his speed from 60 to 75 with a similar result. A few minutes later, as he passed a sign indicating a rest stop 1 mile ahead, the motorcycle accelerated into the left lane, rapidly coming abreast of the Outback. The rider, unidentifiable in a helmet with a face shield, extended his hand, holding a gold detective shield, and gestured toward the upcoming exit ramp. The rest area turned out to be nothing more than a row of parking spaces in front of a small brick building that housed a pair of restrooms. The area was isolated from the highway by a line of overgrown shrubbery. As the motorcycle pulled in and stopped a couple of spaces away, the loneliness of the place prompted Gurney to move his Beretta handgun from his glove compartment to his jacket pocket. When the rider stepped off the machine and removed his helmet, Gurney was surprised to see that it was Mark Torres.
"Sorry if you thought I was following you. I live out this way, my wife and I, in Larvotton, at the next exit."
"And?"
"I wanted to talk to you. I'm not sure whether it's okay to be speaking to you directly, I mean privately like this. I don't like going outside channels with everything supposed to be going through Deputy Chief Turlock, but then I decided it would be sort of okay since we've met before."
"We have?"
"You probably wouldn't remember, but I attended a seminar you gave at the Academy a couple of years ago on investigative procedures. It was really amazing."
"I'm glad you enjoyed it, but I should get to the point."
It looked like the idea was causing him physical pain.
"The thing is, I kind of feel in this case like I'm in a little over my head."
Gurney waited as a series of heavy trucks roared by on the far side of the bushes.
"In what way?"
"I just got promoted from patrol to the detective bureau 6 months ago. To be put in this position on a case like this, with so much at stake?"
He shook his head.
"To be honest, I'm a little uncomfortable."
The hint of an accent was creeping into his voice.
"With the responsibility or something else?"
Torres hesitated.
"Well, it's sort of like I'm the case CIO and sort of not. Chief Beckert seems to be running it, like this thing of staying focused on Jordan and Tooker like he's positive they're guilty. But I don't see enough evidence to be that positive about it myself. Is this a big mistake, talking to you directly about this?"
"That depends on what you want from me.
Maybe just your phone number? I'd love to be able to bounce things off you, unless that's a problem.
Gurney saw no reason to refuse, regardless of how rigid Beckert might be about the flow of information. He shrugged and gave the young detective his cell number. Torres thanked him and then was gone, leaving Gurney to muse over the encounter. Like everything else in the case, it felt not quite right. He wondered if the secrecy surrounding the request was the product of Torres's insecurity, the White River police culture, or something nastier altogether. His musings were interrupted by the passing shadows of a pair of vultures circling over the weedy field adjacent to the restrooms. It was interesting, he thought, that vultures, nurturing themselves only from the bodies of dead animals, harming no living thing, had become, in popular parlance, predators devouring the defenseless. More evidence that the popular mind was rarely distracted by the truth. These musings were interrupted in turn by the ringing of his phone. It was Hardwick.
Gurney here?
Damn. That text you sent me from Seal's phone could be a legit warning. Or something pretending to be a legit warning. Or some other fucking thing entirely. You know where the call came from?
We can pursue that when we get possession of the phone from Steele's wife. But I'm sure the pursuit will dead-end at an anonymous prepaid cell. You have anything on Beckert or Turlock?
A bit more than before. I called in a favor from a guy at NYSP headquarters with access to old recruitment archives. The original forms with the CV data provided by applicants. Beckert's and Turlock's applications reveal a very early connection. They both attended the same military prep school in Butchers County, Virginia. And Beckert was a year ahead of Turlock, but it was a small school, and they would have trained together.
Interesting.
And also interesting is a notation on Turlock's application indicating that he had legal problems back at that school. Juvenile court hearing, proceedings sealed. Applicant explanation supported by Butchers County Sheriff's affidavit deemed adequate for application to proceed at this time. That's all the notation says.
The vulture shadows passed again across the pavement and out across the scraggly field.
Did Beckert have any problems there? If so, nobody noticed. Top of his class every year, clean as Butchers County spring water.
Be nice to know what Turlock got banged up for.
We need a hell of a good cause to persuade a Virginia judge to open the sealed juvie file of a deputy police chief. And, as of now, we have no cause at all.
Be nice to find one.
For a guy who's not sure he wants to get involved, you sound pretty damn involved.
Gurney waited for another noisy convoy of trucks to pass.
And one little peculiarity seems to lead to another, that's all.
Like what?
Like the relationship Klein has with Beckert. Klein describes him as a law-and-order god, even told me in a worshipful tone that Beckert is married to the governor's cousin. So?
So why doesn't he trust this paragon of justice?
You don't think he does?
I think something about Beckert's approach to this homicide has Klein running scared.
The fuck you think is going on?
I don't know. Something to do with Beckert's plan to run for attorney general?
Hardwick let out a braying laugh.
What's so funny?
Something I just heard. Latest rumor is that the former AG's passing on to his heavenly reward in a Vegas hotel was more colorful than first revealed. Seems there was a hooker trapped under the fat fucker's 300-pound corpse.
This has some relevance to Beckert?
It dumps the former AG's character into the shitter, which is a plus for Mr. Law and Order. Clean new broom to sweep out the nasty crap.
Gurney thought about this for a moment. You told me the other day that Beckert's first wife died of a drug overdose. You have anything more on that?
There was no legal case, so no case records. The fuck would that have to do with anything anyway?
No idea. I'm just asking questions.
When Gurney arrived home, he found Geraldine Merkel's yellow beetle parked by the asparagus patch. He was led by the sound of female laughter to the patio. Geraldine and Madeline were doubled over.
Finally, Madeline got hold of herself and said, "Welcome home, sweetheart. Jerry was just describing an encounter with a client."
"Sounds like fun."
"Oh, you have no idea," said Geraldine, her round face a picture of glee. "I've got to be going now. Buford gets a little crazy if he doesn't get his dinner on time."
She stood up, surprisingly nimble for a rotund woman, and hurried off to her beetle.
As she was fitting herself into the driver's seat, she called back, "Thanks for the tea, my dear." With a burst of giggles, she drove off. Madeline responded to Gurney's quizzical expression with a dismissive little wave of her hand. "Just a bit of dark clinic humor. Hard to explain. You had to be there." She wiped her face again and cleared her throat. "I thought we'd have dinner out here this evening. The air is pure heaven." He shrugged. "Fine with me." She went into the house and came back 10 minutes later with placemats, silverware, and two large bowls brimming with her favorite salad of cold shrimp, avocado, diced tomatoes, red leaf lettuce, and crumbled blue cheese. They were both hungry and hardly spoke until they were finished. The four chickens were pursuing their own day-long meal, pecking in the grass around the edges of the patio. "Buford is her cat," said Madeline, putting down her fork. "I thought it was her husband." "Hasn't got a husband. Seems happy enough without one." After a pause, Gurney launched into a summary of all that had transpired that day, including his meeting with Klein in the parking lot. "The more he tells me how open and honest he's being with me, the less I believe it. So I guess I need to make a decision." Madeline said nothing, just cocked her head and eyed him incredulously. "You think my involvement is a bad idea?" he asked.
"A bad idea? Is it a bad idea to let yourself be used in a murder investigation by a man you think is lying to you? To put your life in the hands of a man you don't trust? My God, David, on what planet would that be considered a good idea?"
Putting his life in Klein's hands might be an overly dramatic way of looking at it, but she had a point. "I'll sleep on it."
"Really?"
"Really." In his own mind, he was inclined to continue his investigation, at least for a while. What he intended to sleep on was his relationship with Klein. She gazed at him for a long moment. Then she gathered up their salad bowls and forks and carried them into the house. He took out his phone and looked up the number Kim Steele had given him. The call went to her voicemail. He left a message saying it would be helpful for him to have her husband's phone with whatever digital information might be stored in it. He avoided using language that sounded peremptory. He knew his best chance of getting her agreement lay in giving her the option of refusing. Then he sat back in his chair, closed his eyes, and tried to put the jumble of the day behind him. But his mind kept going back to the unusual power dynamic of the White River meeting. Beckert clearly being the man in charge, despite being outranked by the three elected officials at the table, the mayor, the district attorney, and the blind sheriff. He was still sitting there on the patio half an hour later, trying to relax in the sweetly scented spring breezes, when he heard Madeline stepping back onto the patio. He opened his eyes and saw that she was fresh from a shower, hair still damp, barefoot, wearing only panties and a t-shirt. She smiled. "I thought we should probably get to bed early." It proved to be a wonderful solution to his focus problem. The next morning he awoke with a start. He'd been dreaming that he was lying in the bottom of his excavation, shackled by a black iron chain to the foundation wall. A blind man in dark glasses was standing at the edge of the excavation, brandishing a long white cane. He slashed the cane viciously back and forth, each slash creating a high-pitched scream. As Gurney came to his senses in the bed next to Madeline, the screaming became the ringing of the phone on the nightstand. He picked it up, blinking his eyes to clear his vision. He saw on the screen that the caller was Sheridan Klein. He cleared his throat and pressed talk.
"Gurney here."
Klein's voice was shrill.
"About time you picked up."
Gurney glanced at the clock on the night table. It was 7:34 a.m.
"Is there a problem?"
"An hour ago, Del Beckert got a call from the pastor of White River's largest Episcopal church. He was concerned about Beckert's statement on Ram News."
"Meaning what?"
"It sounded to him like Beckert was saying that Jordan and Tooker were cop killers."
"The pastor was upset by that?"
"Furious."
"Because?"
"Because Marcel Jordan and Virgil Tooker just happened to have been meeting with him in the parish house at the time Steele was shot, discussing ways to end the violence."
"Jesus."
"That's why they left the demonstration early, meaning they have what is known as a rock-solid alibi. They didn't do it. Couldn't have done it. Not unless we want to believe the most popular white pastor in White River is in the pocket of the BDA.
Okay, so they didn't do it. They have an alibi. So what?
So what? So what? So they were just found. That's so what?
Found?
Found. Dead.
What?
Stripped, naked, tied to the jungle gym in the Willard Park playground, apparently beaten to death in the goddamn playground.